Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
We did it again. We've done that several times in the last couple of hours.
What's
and
that?
You haven't, we said our names. You haven't acted like there was a great accomplishment.
I'm trying to reduce my excitement over the ability right there to say our names at the beginning of the show together in harmony.
Well, if we reduce our excitement there, we lose a little bit of wonder in the world.
We
you
do.
Know? Kids smile 400 times a day below the age of 6. Most adults smile between 10 and 20 times a day. If we can smile because we said our own names, let's do it.
So if we can smile 400 times, we'll be two-year-olds?
Of course.
And the word in French for small children is?
Idiot.
Idiot, so we'll be idiots. I love it. That's cool. Okay.
Yes.
We can work on being idiots.
Yes, we will do our best.
And you can give us a call in here and raise our intelligence level by asking some intelligent questions. 773-1400 is the number if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
And we didn't even talk about the fact that the major large cap indices, I love using indices.
You like to say indices.
We're up again this week and
broke all records.
On Thursday, before they most of them went down just a little bit on Friday, they were most of them, well, like the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average were sitting at record levels again.
Yeah.
You know, I'm beginning to not like the major market indices. Not like them.
What did they do to you?
Well, It's not what they did to me. It's that we have been saying for years
that's a long conversation.
That they are artificial, they are wrong.
Yeah.
And the reason is that there's a huge inflow of money into index mutual funds that mimic those indices. And as a result, when the money flows into those funds, the indices reflect the inflow of money from the funds rather than reflecting what's really going on out there.
Do you mind if I use my analogy here? I've polished it over the years. It's a pretty good one.
Your analogy?
Yes, for what indexes
General Motors.
Are. Well, no, it's better than that one.
It's better than the General Motors analogy.
Yes.
Okay.
An index, just like a flood gauge, is just something to measure volume. This is how much stuff is going on and the level of it. So if you think of the S&P 500 as it's intended to be, is paint on the side of the pool measuring the depth of the water. This is great. We can see, look, the economy is moving, the stock market and these big 500 companies, they're doing this. We can measure the movement. Unfortunately, once people start using the measuring device as an investment vehicle, as something to hold water, it stops being the paint on the side of the pool. Do you remember the old coffee makers that had the glass vials that sit out there so that you could see how much water was in the back reserve tank? Do you remember that?
Actually, the Keurig coffee makers have the tank over
yeah,
on the side.
Yeah, you can see that.
See
you can just see the whole tank. But the old coffee makers, they had those vials on the outside. You could show how much water was inside the reserve on there so you didn't overfill it. The way we do, or the way people invest these days, is that they put money into index-mimicking funds, which is like pouring the water into the little glass vial instead of putting it in the reserve. You don't know how much is in the reserve if you're pouring the water into the vial. You can overflow the vial, and you think, oh, the reserve is full, and then you see it kind of slow down as you it's lowering itself down as you stop pouring the water in. And that's what's going on with the index. The index is meant to measure the movements of the stock market. But when you invest in the measurement, it doesn't make any sense anymore. And that was my analogy. There you go.
Well, okay. I'll take that analogy.
It's got water and coffee and some pools. And I think it's a pretty good analogy. I mean,
well, the reason I don't like those indexes more than anything else, we've been issuing warnings. We actually write them into our investment policy statements now. Back in the 1990s, late 1990s, mid to late 1990s, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index and Dow Jones Industrial Average took off for the stratosphere.
They
the numbers went up dramatically. Meanwhile, the value indexes or indices, which are composed of value stocks and things like that, did very poorly. I mean, they rose consistently during that same period, but they didn't shoot up. And people beat me up at the time, and I unfortunately did a little cave in the 1990s, like most people who were stockbrokers, and finally started selling people what they wanted, and then got beat up for it. But the point is that we just saw in the last, so far year to date, we are seeing a boom emerge in the large cap domestic indexes or indices. Whether it will continue, I don't know, but I think the mid to late 1990s is now behind us, far enough that we have forgotten. And if you look at some of the other indexes, the ones that are very, very consistent, the ones that have had the best long-term returns, some of those didn't do so well in the first quarter, and we're actually getting people. I've had several people who have asked me, well, if the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up that much, why wasn't my portfolio up that much? And the answer, if your portfolio went up as much as the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500 in the first quarter, you got a problem. I know that sounds really goofy.
Seems backwards.
You got a serious problem, because one of the things that's consistently been demonstrated over the last 60-some years, consistently, absolutely no exceptions, is if you have a lot of volatility in a portfolio, you have a lot of volatility in a portfolio. Meaning...
Whoa, that's a...
Okay, the point
that's
is...
That's called tautology, what you just did.
Well, the point is that you can't capture the upside of the volatility and ignore the and miss the downside, despite the fact in with 2020 hindsight, it seems like it'd be easy to catch all the upside and miss the downside, and so that you could just make lots and lots of gazillions of dollars in money. And there are actually some people who did that, but so far everyone who did it consistently over any reasonable period of time has been shown to have been cheating or lying. Madoff did it. What's his name? Stanford did it.
Yeah.
Several hedge fund managers consistently apparently were able to do it, and they or their subordinates or somebody one at a time are going to prison over it. It's called insider trading. As a matter of fact, there was a guy who apparently was doing it out in California because he played golf with a senior partner at KPMG. I don't know if you read about that this week.
Mm-hmm.
And the senior partner at KPMG, who was very wealthy and had a very, very good income,
didn't think it was enough, I guess.
No, this is the big question. $50,000 over the time period that he was giving insider illegal information to this guy who had a diamond shop. It was basically a diamond salesman, and he was hurting for certain. $50,000 over that period of time was peanuts to this guy. So the question is, why was he giving insider information?
Prestige, I think.
Of course, the guy actually made $1.2 million in his stock account during the time period.
No, yeah, that probably had something to do with it as well. If he's doing it for himself, might as well share it with his friends.
No. The guy he was giving the information
the diamonds?
To...
Oh, yes. Okay.
The salesman he was giving the information to... on the golf course, who was in the country club with him, made $1.2 million in the market over this time period by trading on this insider information. The guy who was giving him the insider information, senior partner, 29 years at KPMG, had 500 partner-level auditors working under him. Got a total of $50,000. And you know when the majority of that was? It was on a sting operation where they had caught the guy who was doing the trading.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to reduce his sentence, he was going to turn in his source of information as part of the plea bargain. So they wired him. And get this. They gave him $50,000 in cash. he put it in a garbage bag and handed it to the guy on the golf course. And apparently, that was the total net, if you count everything. Apparently, he gave him some watches and some odds and ends, but the gifts were going both ways.
Right.
Until that event. And I just, you know, by the way, folks, the reason I'm going on and on about this is the SEC caught both parties on this insider trading. I'm proud of the SEC.
Yeah, good job.
Because it, you know, I think that, you know, one of the articles that I read suggested that maybe they thought they were such small traders. The guy really was, you know, he just had one little account and that they didn't think, and it was in a discount broker, and mm-hmm. he didn't realize that he was going to get caught.
Well, let me come at this from a different direction, and it's one that I think a lot of people get trapped in a mentality. Most people don't really understand what's wrong with insider trading. They don't understand it. They think, well, you've got insider information. You should be able to make some money off of it. Why not?
All the big guys on Wall Street do it.
Right.
Yeah, but then they get to wear orange jumpsuits.
Yeah. Here's the problem with it. When you buy or sell on the market, and you're not doing it to hold for a long period of time, so we're going to call it trading, day trading, instead of normal investing, long-term investing. When you day trade, it's like playing poker. If you're all day traders sitting around the trading table, in order to make money, somebody has to lose money. In a long-term investment, you have the ability to do what our caller last hour was talking about, concentrate on sales, raising your revenue of the companies, all kinds of other things, long-term. But if you're a day trader, it is a fixed sum. The amount of money on the table is all there is, and there's no more. In order to make money in that situation, you have to take it from other people. It's kind of like going to a poker table when you can see the cards that the other people have. You're not making money from the company whose insider information you have. You're making money from other people that are interested in buying or selling that company. And that's why the SEC goes in and says, you just stole that money from other people. It isn't stealing from the company. It isn't stealing. There are people on the other end of that transaction. And that's the thing that I think most people completely forget, because they think the big guys on Wall Street, they have information, they're using it. If you obtain information that isn't available to everybody at the table, then you're, in essence, either doing research on your own, and this is a good thing, if you go to Vegas and you play poker and you know really know the statistics on the cards, that's not cheating. That's getting good at what you do. That's what the big boys do in Vegas. That's what the big boys do on Wall Street. They understand the game they're playing. If you start looking at other people's cards at the table and knowing the cards that are being dealt from the dealer before they hit the table, that's cheating. That's wrong. There's no way of looking at that and saying, oh, that's a fine thing to do. If you know the cards, you should be able to do it. Not unless you do it by skill. If you do it by getting told something, that's cheating, guys. And that's why the SEC is upset about it.
It's kind of like, yeah, I guess it's kind of like if you, insider trading is like if your partner, let's say your wife's with you while you're playing, and she gets up every few minutes and walks around the table and can see over the shoulders to see what other people are holding.
Yeah, or even, it's even better than that. It's like the dealer told you the order of the cards before the dealing was done. Mm-hmm. Because that's the insider information that we're talking about. You know something. You didn't need somebody leaning over a shoulder to say what's in your stock portfolio. You knew what the card was going to be before it was dealt. That's just wrong.
Yeah.
It's not nice.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if we mentioned this earlier. Gold is officially in a bear market now.
We said it, but we should. I think it's worth
reiterating. Yeah, that's right. We did talk about the gold. Is, you know, we talk about asset classes, and that's what we work with is asset classes on a regular basis. And there are two asset classes recently that have plunged, one of which I think is going to do very well in the future, and one of which is probably going to keep plunging. Diversified emerging markets is down, certainly not in bear market territory, but it's down a couple of percent this year. It's one of the asset classes we use pretty regularly, and this is one of those things to learn. Over the long term, we track about 23 asset classes. diversified emerging markets has the highest long-term return. So obviously, if you're interested in a long-term investor, and this is very consistent as far back as we have records, diversified emerging market stocks would probably be a pretty good thing to have in your portfolio. Except this first quarter, well, the domestic market indices are up a whole bunch. Diversified emerging markets were down. Now, there's a very good reason they're down temporarily, short term. Cyprus scared the out of a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot that goes into long-term effective investing. Just like during the break, I was talking about the fact that every time I run an analysis, I am very tempted to buy long-term treasuries.
Yeah, because when we look at long-term treasuries, the recent history, they have done a phenomenal job. They are performing like crazy. The problem with it is it looks a lot like, as we were saying on the break, it looks very, very much like large cap growth positions in the year 2000, early 2000. It's really easy to look at it and say, wow, we need to get into that. But that's what crashed. And they're way above their averages.
You know, I have to keep patting myself on the back, and I keep holding my breath. You know, I would have thought that by now interest rates would be starting up. They're not, by the way. The 10-year Treasury, and I know the only geeks like us follow this kind of thing, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, which is the, quote, benchmark, 1.73% interest. You buy one today, fresh minted from the United States government, which you can buy them for $1,000 from the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas. You just have to contact them, and you send them $1,000, and they send you a brand-new U.S. Treasury 10-year note. Actually, they prefer to do it electronically. Send you one if you ask them to. The interest you would receive per year on that note, if you bought one today, is 1.73% per year. Now, the good news is 10 years from now, there is effectively zero financial risk in the thing. Now, if an asteroid smacks into the country and destroys the United States of America or something, obviously you don't get the money, but the money's not worth anything.
Well, wait a minute. Let's use a more plausible thing.
What?
North Korea launches a nuke at Colorado Springs and instead hits Louisiana.
No, that's the asteroid's more likely. we could go into that, too.
Yes, we could.
About the fact that
it's not likely at all.
That threat of, anyway.
They just released a new video. That's why I said this. They said that they're also, recently they have claimed that they were going to hit Los Angeles, Austin, Texas,
right,
and Washington, D.C. Well, this newest video that came out yesterday includes Colorado Springs, the Air Force Academy.
Right.
Only the problem is that the dot for the Air Force Academy on the map of the United States puts it right around Shreveport, Louisiana.
Really?
Yeah, and it's a straight line shot again.
Well, the interesting thing is it's physically,
doesn't go over the pole.
It's
or
physically impossible to take a flat map and shoot a ballistic missile. That's why they're called ballistic. They have laws they have to follow, ballistic laws. It's physically impossible to fire a ballistic missile on the path that they were showing on the map. Then they didn't know that, which tells
that
you,
says something about,
you know, anyway.
Something anywhere.
Well, but I think that's where they've got Madoff now.
Could be.
You know, he basically created a fictional fund that always went up, and it was a straight line increase in return every year, and everybody wants one of those. Anyway, never mind my
you were in the middle of talking about worst-case scenarios, what happens if an asteroid hits, when I tried to put in a plausible thing. So
yeah, but I completely – why was I saying that?
I'm talking about
– oh, the U.S. Treasury.
Yes, treasuries.
I would have thought by now interest rates would have started to go up. They haven't. Matter of fact, they've actually come down in the first quarter a little bit. The 30-year Treasury is now below 3%. The 10-year Treasury is below 2%. As long as interest stay this low, bonds previously owned bonds do very, very well. And we've talked about this a lot, probably too much. We have some very relatively short-term hedged, if you will, positions in bonds for people as cushions. We expect a 2% or so total return per year out of those positions. People don't like it right now when they see the Dow Jones Industrial Average and S&P 500 going up, and we've heard a little bit of noise about that. But here is the essence of the problem. Interest rates will start up at some point. And let me give you an example. If today you went out to the, and believe me, these people are having this happen, stockbroker calls you up and says, I can get you a treasury bond that matures in 10 years that pays 7.36% interest.
Ooh, that sounds interesting, they say.
People are buying those.
Yeah, there's a problem with that.
And
kind of a major problem,
yeah,
a series of major problems.
The price on that bond, and people don't understand that, is 155. They say, oh, well, okay, 155. I don't care. As long as it's paying me 7% interest.
It's not.
Well, but it is. They get a check for
7% of
$1,000. They get their.
They only had to spend $1,550.
But it's still the coupon on it is 7 point yeah. something percent.
Yeah. The yield to maturity is what people need to be looking at there, and the duration.
And the point is that there's a big article, by the way, Gundlach, a guy named Gundlach, spoke to the Yacht Club of New York, which I guess is a very prestigious place, and it was reported that he said there is no bond bubble, there's no risk, and you know that the it happens that he had the biggest in he runs a bond fund that had the biggest inflows of money last year, bigger than PIMCO's even.
Of course it's not a bubble if you're making money
right.
off of it.
But here's the point, and I actually wrote a response to the article. And here's the point. If you go to those a U.S. Treasury bond that matures in 2023, about now in 2023, in other words, it's a 10-year maturity, the price on that bond before commissions will be somewhere between about 145 and 155. If you hold that bond to maturity, you will lose one-third of your principal value. Did you hear that?
Yep.
Along the way, if you have an intaxable position, you will pay income taxes on that 7% coupon yield on the bond. Full income taxes. But when you lose your one-third of value when it matures, your write-off is only at capital gains rates.
Oops.
And you can only write off $3,000 a year of it unless you've got capital gains to write it off against.
That's a big issue.
If I held something today...
I'm sure the Tea Party likes that. You're paying taxes on things that isn't actual gain.
Right.
And then when you do sell it and you get your losses,
your
you can't write it off against the taxes that you've already paid on it.
Your principal has been being returned to you and you're paying full taxes on it. It gets interesting because here's the point. At some point when you buy that bond, you are guaranteed a one-third drop in value, guaranteed by the federal government to have a one-third drop in value. Better yet, if we get any interest rate rise at all, any significant interest rate rise at all, you could get a bigger than one-third drop in a short period of time. And they say there's not a bond bubble. That's where it is, right there.
There's the bubble.
And it's up. And those Treasury securities went from 100 a few years ago to 155 today. And people are saying, hallelujah, I want more of that. And this is where... It's very similar right now. That particular portion of the bond market is very, very similar to large cap growth in the year 2000. Now, Mr. Gundlach may say that's not a bubble. Maybe it's not a bubble. If you've identified it and everybody says it's there, maybe it's not a bubble, but it's still going to deflate. We have a caller on 1-866-597-1400, and you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Ben. I have a question. Have you heard this recent news about EPA is fixing to implement a rain tax?
A rain tax?
Yeah.
No,
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, Maryland's getting out in front of it, and they're going to do it first before EPA enforces it.
They're going to tax God when it rains?
No, they're going to tax everybody, businesses, I think, right now. If you have a concrete surface or a roof, they're going to tax you for a certain amount.
So that actually... I hate to break this to you or anyone else, but that actually makes a little bit of sense.
It might make a little sense, but
somebody needs to pay. You know, when you pave over an area, if you don't have flood control, if you did it in Austin or something, and you paved over, you put a big paved parking lot in or in a big building that would cause rain to run off quickly.
Yeah.
You have to put in a substantial flood control element there to keep it from flooding people downstream.
Now, and I've got a quick response to that. What you just said is, I'll just throw something in really quick. Texas, at least inside municipalities, has code in place, a law in place that says that you have to design for that to begin with. Mm-hmm. You have to spend the money on the front end. So in a sense, that tax already exists in Texas, only we did it on the front end just like we do with sales tax. It's a much more efficient method.
I think I now know what you're talking about, and I didn't think of it as a tax. They were talking about fees. But let's just say you already have a big parking lot, and you already have a big building, and as a result, people downstream of you are being flooded, and the government is having to bail them out and repair bridges and do things like
flood insurance stuff, all that good stuff.
Because your property is causing them to flood. I think, and I don't know, I haven't seen the one in Maryland, but I heard some proposals a while back. You had a choice. You could either put in a flood abatement facility on your property, in other words, to reduce the speed of the runoff and capture pollution that's in the runoff, or you could pay a tax.
Yeah.
I think that's probably what you're talking about, right?
Well, there's one other aspect here, and this is the thing that twists everybody's mind that I know of in here, because when it comes to private property, water falls into a really strange category. Water falls. You see what I did with the
rain?
Waterfalls?
Yeah. It's called a parking lot. That's a strange
right.
category.
Okay. So in Texas, if you own a property that is on a river, for instance, you may own all the way across the river or halfway across the river. You can't tell people not to get on the water. You can't dam that water. You can't.
Oh, I during the flood, I was.
There's a lot of things that you're not allowed to do with the water, because water rights are very, very different than property rights. Water is free-flowing, and it's very easy to damage other people's property by changing the water stream. That is the issue here, and that's something... This is common law that goes way back before England. It's the same kind of law that governs wildlife. It's why the state says on your property you're only allowed to harvest a certain number of deer, because they figure the deer are moving around on lots of people's properties. Unless you put up big fences and say those deer can't affect other deer, you have to follow very strict rules. And you're not allowed to put up fences in the water or dams in that case, because it will affect other people's property.
Except recently the Supreme Court of Texas said when it comes to underground water, none of that applies.
Yeah, none of that applies. We can... So that's an issue that is a little bit strange, and it is in Maryland, because most of their building and concrete and what they call it impervious ground was done before people were thinking about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
They're in trouble already, and they didn't spend the money at the beginning. In Texas, like many other things that Texas does, somebody thought ahead a bit, and they said this code that we're putting into place says you've got to pay some extra building requirements. It's why there are the type of ditches that we have, drainage ditches that we have all over the place, that are, if you go to the northeast, you'll find that there's a lot less of those, and yet they get a lot more rain. So the tax in Maryland, I don't see that coming to Texas. But
well, we already have it in a sense.
In a sense. It's just like sales tax instead of an income tax. It's a it at the time of purchase.
What if you put in something like, say your driveway is unpaved or doesn't have, it's not concrete or anything, you just you go ahead and put in a concrete or unpaved,
I think it's only commercial facilities. Only,
well, I heard it. It was they said right now it's commercial. They're thinking about, you know, depends on how much money they get, I guess.
Well,
you go to private too.
Well, and the point is that if you, let me give you an example on the driveways. I did a little research on this. In Salado, there's an area where a number of houses were flooded recently, and a lot of damage was done. And the federal government and the city, the village government and the state and everything have stepped in to do abatement and repair things, and they've had to rebuild the road. A lot of money's been spent because of the flood, and these houses are in the floodplain. Now, here's the point. When they were built, they weren't in the floodplain. And why did the floodplain move? Because there were major housing developments built upstream.
Ooh, even better. Global warming.
Oh, don't do that. No, no. It had nothing to do with global warming.
That happened yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
There were major housing developments during the period when there was no, when Salado wasn't a village and there wasn't, you know, and basically nobody was controlling the building process. And as these houses, what happened is upstream, because of all the impervious surfaces, roofs and driveways and streets, the runoff from upstream of these houses was greatly increased over the last several decades. As a result, the people who built the houses saying, we're not in the floodplain, we've done something very reasonable here, got flooded. And we, the taxpayers, then ultimately have to pay for that damage. Given that as an issue, I can certainly see where it's just like the property tax you pay now, where they look at the square feet in your house and they tax you on it. I can clearly see that they might at some point look at your impervious surfaces and give you an opportunity, by the way, to put in a facility to offset that runoff.
Yeah, this is where...
Like a large rainwater barrel?
Yeah, a really, really large rainwater.
Well, yeah, sort of. That's you've seen those, by the way, in new construction. You've seen those little holding ponds they have around them and the gravel that's in them.
This is where economists come in weirdly, because when
economists always come in weirdly.
When we talk about taxes and you hear us talking about Maryland, it might be a good idea to have this tax, people go, oh, the McClures, they like taxes. They want a bigger government. From an economic perspective, what we try to do is say, where is money being spent and by whom? And if it's being spent by people that aren't getting the benefit of it, but only getting the damage of it, then it's not being spent in the right area. If it's being spent by the people that are creating the damage and getting the benefit, then it's a good, it's a healthy way of doing it. This is the reason why we like a sales tax rather than an income tax, is because you get to choose to pay the tax when you get a benefit. The income tax, you get to pay the tax before you get a benefit. You haven't spent it on anything. You can't eat money. You can't sleep on money comfortably anyway. So when we're talking about the taxes in Maryland over the... there's two issues at stake here. One is the damage and the benefit of the water, and two is who's spending to receive the benefit and the damage. And thankfully, we live in Texas where somebody thought about that a little bit early.
Yeah, well, also we're getting less and less rain.
That's true.
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
You know, we were talking about this Ben Bernanke and him ordering a print of more money. I think that's right.
Yeah, but he hasn't, but anyway.
Sort of. It's just a slang term for what he's doing, yeah.
Can you explain to me how that is not inflation?
Sure, but we need to play some commercials
first.
Well,
I'll hit that, and then we go to the commercials.
That's a really easy answer?
Yeah, it's really simple. Inflation is when you have more money in circulation. Inflation occurs when you have more money available than you have goods and services, okay? Make sense?
Yeah.
We had... depending on who you look at, who you talk to, somewhere between $14 and $16 trillion disappear out of our economy in 2008 and 2009. Just go, gone. Okay?
People, there's a point here that most people miss. We say it's when the loans weren't paid back, and they say, well, wait a minute, how is that even, you know, loans?
But
the reality is that people, they were given money by a bank, and then they defaulted on it. They just didn't have the money to pay it back. That money disappeared.
To make it simple, if you have a bond, you've loaned money to someone, you have a piece of paper. If that, it's kind of like putting money in the bank. When you put money in the bank, that's loaning money to the bank. You get that?
Yeah.
If you had $100,000 in the bank, and the bank went bad and you only got $70,000 back, you would acknowledge that $30,000 of your money just disappeared, right?
Well, it's not there, but I wouldn't say it just disappeared.
It's gone.
Well, you don't have it. So
No one else has got it either.
Collected the money. Somebody spent it rather than giving it back to you.
You know,
That's what I'm saying.
They used it to buy a house, but the house isn't worth what it was worth anymore. I mean, the money's gone. It just disappeared out of the economy. That happens.
Yeah.
In a deflationary environment, which is what we had.
Money's created when loans are paid back properly.
The Federal Reserve is kind of like a gigantic spleen. When we have too much money in the system, their job is to take money out of the system. And they do that by selling bonds. They sell treasury bonds, mortgage bonds, whatever. And if you buy a $1,000 bond that was put into the system by the Federal Reserve, $1,000 disappeared out of your pocket, and it's gone. It's
You're
not
in
the
economy. Spending that right now. It's sitting in a bond somewhere.
They can basically suck the money out of the economy, which they did under Paul Volcker. When we have a lot of money suddenly disappear from the economy, which we did in 2008 and 2009, the Federal Reserve's job is to replace that money. And they didn't even replace as much money has disappeared.
Right. They're buying mortgage-backed securities, and they're buying them at massive discounts. So the money that was out there, the whole QE3, the $85 billion a month that people hear about, they're buying very specific types of bonds. These are mortgage-backed securities that, when they were sold at $1,000. And the Fed is buying them back between $700 and $900 a piece. So that money that's going back in from the Federal Reserve is, by definition, less than disappeared.
And they are, in effect, replacing reserves that the banks paid $1,000 for with $700 to $900 a pop, and the banks are using their profits to cover the difference, so they're not doing particularly well financially. And the whole point is that the Federal Reserve's job is both to prevent inflation and deflation.
Deflation is less well-known.
And in this case, they are buying bonds, putting money into the economy. They don't have any printing presses. They're using money that they took out of the economy under Paul Volcker to put money. Oops, I just hung up on you. I'm sorry. Okay, and I've got another caller in here. Sorry.
So I think we did fairly well there, and we do have to play some commercials. So the caller that's on there now, if you can hold for just a minute, we'll play some commercials and come back to you.
Yes, we'll be back on the other side after these important words from KTEM sponsor. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Telephone numbers in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Or afternoon, is it? No,
almost afternoon.
Well, it all depends on where you are.
Right. Well, I'm just outside of Temple.
Outside of Temple includes most of the planet.
If we just keep this conversation going for about 10 minutes, it'll be afternoon.
Yeah, okay. Anyway. Go ahead.
Let's face it, some people are just nuts.
Us.
we represent that remark.
Yes.
Okay. Listen, I have a question now. I hear people often say they're the bank's money. And maybe I'm mistaken here and I just don't understand things. But the bank does not have any money except the money that the people put therein. So it's not the bank's money. It is the people's money. Furthermore.
There are some issues with that, but yeah, go ahead.
Well, why would you have issues with it.
If well,
all the
because
it,
there is
money out of the bank would fold.
Well, that is true. But in order to have a bank start, you have to have money there to give loans at the very beginning. You also have to have reserves on hand that represent a major portion of the deposits. So you have to have money beyond what is in the bank.
And I hate to break this to you, but when you put money in the bank, it becomes the property of the bank.
It's like doing a loan to the government or anywhere else, or them giving you a mortgage. You can spend that mortgage on a house, and it's your choice what house you spend it on.
Yeah, and the point is, like, when you put money into an insurance company, people, let's say that you purchased a fixed annuity in an insurance company, and you expect it to pay you for the rest of your life.
That sounds like a big Ponzi scheme, but
well, it is in some
sense. It is,
but the point is that if that insurance company goes under, you will suddenly discover that that was their money.
Of course, and you got to,
and you are a creditor.
But what I was getting at is that even if the bank starts out with, let's say, $1,000,
okay,
a fractional reserve banking is what 10% of what they loan out, they have to have on hand.
More like 8, but yeah.
And it depends on what the Federal Reserve is requiring at any given moment.
Okay, but as an example, if they got a dollar and it's 10%, then they could loan out $10. That's interesting because I just built a house.
They have to come up with that other
$9. Somebody's got to put deposits in there, yeah.
If they have $1,000, they're allowed to give out $900. They're not allowed to give out $9,000. They don't have $9,000 to give out.
Unless you're in Cyprus.
Right. In Cyprus, they can give out $9,000 if they have $1,000.
Well.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring up. I just built a house 4 years ago.
Right.
I walked into the bank with $100,000 cash. Handed to the bank, and this was to be used while the house was being built.
Right.
When that money ran out, the bank would then supposedly give the builder money. In actuality, all they did, if I understand this correctly, is they just made computer-generated entries in bookkeeping entries. So the only money involved in building a house is the cash money out of my pocket when it first gets started, plus the cash money out of my pocket as I pay the note every month.
Doesn't quite work that way, but
and how does it work?
Well, what happens is the bank actually holds money, but the money they hold, it's the balance sheet thing. It belongs to the bank.
Well, initially and if they, it belonged to the people, and the people were foolish enough to put their money in the bank, which I've done savings. Now the bank could fold and
the FDIC would cover it.
That's the insurance on it, yeah.
If the FDIC's got any money, but of course they're going to get their money from where?
The FDIC, no, they get their money. The FDIC is funded by the banks.
Yeah, the banks pay an insurance premium to be part of the FDIC. And one of the interesting factors is that the government itself only had to pay into the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation a very small amount of money, even with all these bank failures.
And it's loaned it and
paid
back.
Yeah. It's been paid back at much interest. The government has made profit off of that from the banks.
Well, I don't know about the profit part, but I do know this much. The Federal Reserve Bank is a private organization owned by banks and not the federal government.
That is correct.
It's owned by banks, but it's controlled by the federal government.
Very little control. They've never been audited. We'll start with that point.
And I'm really happy about that.
Yeah. We've got to play some commercials real quick. We can. This would be enough for a 2-hour program, and we have had 2-hour programs on this particular subject before. And what you're saying is, while it's true, it doesn't cover all of the aspects of it. So it's really easy to look at it and get a different opinion of it.
When people say the Federal Reserve has never been successfully audited, well, neither has the Defense Department.
Well, so, this is true,
Next week we will spend more time on that, the nature of money and what the Federal
Appreciate
Reserve is.
Appreciate your call. Give us another call next week and stimulate our brains, okay?
Bye.
Thanks for the call.
And we got a break for commercials, and we're not going to have but just a few seconds on the other side. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with another couple of seconds of the Personal Wealth Coach. We're almost out of time. I do want to point out those commercials that just played, we have no control of them.
We do not endorse them anyway.
We do not endorse them. As a matter of fact, one of them is something that we would consider to be somewhat illicit. Anyway, telephone numbers to call to get us to speak to us off the air. During the week, obviously, we have somebody there, but...
On the weekend, it's voicemail.
It's voicemail. Locally, you can call 947-1111.
Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 1-800-914-7526. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.
And until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. You are listening to News Radio 14 KTEM. And we're going to a Purity Products infomercial.
In progress.
Which is already in progress, in which they tell you at the beginning that nothing that they offer is designed to treat a person for anything medical or any disease. And here they are.
Red wine actually promotes our...